Outside Europe, to be sure, the imperial rule of Britain was a good deal less peaceful, and that of the United States has not been much better. Furthermore, peace, stability, and a Victorian ideal of good government for the natives are not necessarily the only benefits by which to measure. By this, I don't mean to bring up such intangibles as freedom and self-determination, though, of course, they also have a place in any meaningful moral calculus. The issue I have in mind is one of cold, hard economics. A broader view of history may be useful here. The first explorers to venture outwards from Europe into the wider world encountered civilizations that were far wealthier than anything back home. After returning to Italy from the Far East in 1295, Marco Polo was mocked as Marco Millions for stories of China's vast riches, which later travelers found to be largely accurate. When the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama made the first European voyage around the southern tip of Africa and on to India in 1497, he and his crew were stunned by the extraordinary prosperity of the Indian society they encountered. When Hernan Cortes reached the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan in 1519, similarly, it was easily among the most populous cities on the planet. Current estimates range from 200,000 to 300,000 within the city alone and another million in the urban region surrounding it, as well as one of the richest. A few centuries later, at the zenith of Europe's Age of Empire, China, India, and Mexico ranked among the world's poorest nations, while England, which had been a soggy backwater on the fringes of Europe known mostly for codfish and wool, was one of its richest. In 1600, for example, India accounted for an estimated 24% of the world's gross domestic product, while all of Britain managed around 3%. Three centuries later, India was among the most poverty-stricken nations on earth, while England had become the center of the global economy. Plenty of reasons have been advanced for this astonishing reversal, but there are times when the obvious explanation is also the correct one, and this is one of those. To make the point more clearly, consider that the 5% of humanity that lives in the United States of America uses around a quarter of the world's energy and roughly a third of its raw materials and industrial product. This disproportionate share of the world's wealth doesn't come to us because the rest of the world doesn't want such things, or because the United States manufactures some good or provides some service so desirable to the rest of the world that other nations vie with each other to buy it from us. Quite the contrary. The United States produced very little during much of its empire's most prosperous period, and the rest of the world's population is, by and large, just as interested in energy, raw materials, and industrial product as Americans are. It's considered distinctly impolite to suggest that the real reason behind the disparity is related to the fact that the United States has more than 500 military bases on other nations' territory, and spends on its armed forces every year roughly the same amount as the military budgets of every other nation on earth put together. Here again, though, the obvious explanation is the correct one. Between 1945 and 2008, the United States was the world's dominant imperial power, filling the same role in the global political system that Britain filled during its own age of empire. And while that imperial arrangement had plenty of benefits, by and large, they flowed in one direction only. With this in mind, we can move to a meaningful definition of empire. An empire is an arrangement among nations, backed and usually imposed by military force, which extracts wealth from a periphery of subject nations and concentrates it in the imperial core. Put more simply, an empire is a wealth pump, a device to enrich one nation at the expense of others. The mechanism of the pump varies from empire to empire and from age to age. The straightforward extraction of tribute that did the job for ancient Egypt and had another vogue in the time of Imperial Spain has been replaced in most of the most recent empires by somewhat less blatant, though equally effective, systems of unbalanced exchange. While the mechanism varies, though, the underlying principle does not. None of this would have raised any eyebrows at all in the discussion of the mechanics of empire in America or elsewhere during the late 19th century. Such discussions took place in the mass media of the time as well as in the corridors of power, and it was widely understood that the point of having an empire was precisely that it made your nation rich. That's why the United States, after a series of bitter public debates that will be discussed in a later chapter, committed itself to the path of empire in the 1890s. And it's why every nation in Western Europe either had or desperately wanted an overseas empire. Even Belgium had its own little vest pocket empire in Africa and exploited it ruthlessly. The near-total domination of the world by European empires in the 18th and 19th centuries, in conjunction with the popular racism of the time, Kipling's pompous blather about the white man's burden, was embarrassingly typical for its era, has given rise in some circles to the notion that there's something uniquely European, or more precisely, uniquely white, about empire. In reality, of course, the peoples of Europe and the European diaspora were, by and large, Johnny-come-latelys to the business of empire. Ancient Egypt, as already mentioned, was as creative in this as in so many other of the arts of civilization and had a thriving empire that extended far south along the Nile and north along the Mediterranean coast. The great arc of city-states that extended from modern Turkey through the Tigris and Euphrates valleys and the mountains and plateaus further east to the Indus Valley gave rise to dozens of empires at a time when Europe was a patchwork of illiterate tribal societies whose inhabitants still thought bronze was high-tech. China had its own ancient and highly successful empire, and a half a dozen other East Asian nations copied the Chinese model and pursued their own dreams of imperial expansion and enrichment. Sub-Saharan Africa had at least a dozen great empires, while the Aztecs were only the latest in a long history of Native American empires, as splendid and predatory as anything the Old World had to offer. Empire is one of the most common patterns by which nations relate to one another and emerges spontaneously whenever one nation has a sufficient preponderance of power to exploit another. Empires have thus been around for a long time. The evidence of history suggests that they show up promptly, once agriculture becomes stable and sophisticated enough to support urban centers, and go away only when urban life also breaks down. Anyone interested in tracking the rise and fall of empires, thus, has anything up to 5,000 years of fairly detailed information from the Old World and well over 3,000 years from the New. Plenty of data, one might think, for a coherent picture to emerge. Unfortunately, one major difficulty stands in the way of such a picture. Empires attract double talk, the way a dead rat attracts flies. Some of the double talk comes from rival power centers, outside the empire du jour or within it, that hope to excuse their own ambitions by painting that empire in the least complimentary colors that can be found. But an even larger amount gets produced by empires themselves, or more exactly, by the tame intellectuals that empires produce and employ in numbers as large as the imperial economy can support. Between the double talk meant to make any given empire seem much worse than its rivals, and the double talk meant to make the same empire seem much better than its rivals, accurate understanding is an early casualty. At the beginning of this chapter, I mentioned a few examples of the first class of double talk. Examples of the second are just as easy to come by. But one that's particularly relevant here is that shibboleth of contemporary economics, free trade.